So one of the things that I thought would be nice for us to do also, we've been focusing a lot on just like the how-tos of certain actions. We're gonna do that a little bit more today. There's an article that I thought would be good for us to take a look at that's very short, that I think is also important for people who are new to Islam, exploring Islam, people who are recent converts or converted a while ago, that's called Islam and the Cultural Imperative. It's written by a scholar whose name is Dr. Omar Farouk Abdullah. He's from Chicago. He's a convert himself. And I think it's a really helpful article to read as you start to look at practice and ritual, but also understanding that to be Muslim doesn't mean you commit a cultural apostasy of some kind, right? It's not to become Arab or South Asian or any kind of prevailing cultural identity that the religion intertwines with. As I thought in the latter part of today's session, we could just read through that article. It's about a page long. I think it does a very good job at answering questions that preemptively many of you might run into, given that Muslim communities tend to be fairly homogenous, very ethnocentric, and sociologically connect in ways that many religious communities tend to connect in, shared external, shared race, shared ethnicity, shared class. So if we start reading through it, we're not gonna read the whole thing. It is short in the sense that it's not a book, but it's also not like, you know. But I think it's helpful as you start to now familiarize yourself with concepts of theology and fiqh on a practical level. You can also just engage Muslims from so many different backgrounds. They're going to tell you, like quite often definitively, this is what Islam is, where it doesn't necessarily have to be absolute in that sense. Do you know? When it comes to modes of kind of culture and how that intertwines, one of the things that Dr. Omar says in this article that's really great is that he likens the relationship of Islam and culture to a stream that flows over bedrock. And he says the water in a stream inherently takes on the color of the bedrock upon which it flows. And he says this is a relationship of Sharia to culture, and that it's meant to now be indicative of the culture and a reflection of it. So if you go to China, Islam looks Chinese. If you go to Malaysia, Islam looks Malaysian. Right? If you go to Indonesia, it looks Indonesian. Nigeria, it looks Nigerian. Right? You get the idea. The challenge that we run into in the United States is that you have Muslims from all of these cultures within the United States context. Right? Many of us are going for Umrah tomorrow. Right? May Allah accept it from us, make it easy. You all should join us on a future trip. It's a smaller pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina. When you go there, there's like people literally from all over the world. If you go for Hajj, which is a larger pilgrimage in our tradition, we'll probably talk about that, you know, some weeks from now, what that means. It's really amazing to just see how everything functions, because the way the Hajj is set up is you live in tents in a city called Mina. And it's a tent city. Looks very like Lord of the Rings-esque, if you've watched Lord of the Rings, where built into the mountains and across these plains are just all of these tents. And the ways the tents are divided is by the country that you get your visa from. When you walk through this tent city, after a few days of the Hajj, people are able to wear just their regular clothing. And they remove kind of the white sheets that you've probably seen a lot of pictures of when people are performing the pilgrimage. And as you walk through this, you just see how deep like Sharia is and how deep Islam is and how beautiful it is. You go to the tents where people are from, like Malaysia, Indonesia, and there's a lot of different colors and different kind of language spoken. You know, the foods are reflective of the culture. You go then to the Indian subcontinent tents. You know, men are wearing shirts and women that go below their knees. There's some vibrancy to the language. There's more spice in the food. You go to tents from West Africa. There's a lot of beautiful gold and purple like clothing and, you know, language again is distinct, and you kind of get the idea, right? The Gulf states, men are all wearing white, women are dressed in black. And when you come to the American tents or like the UK tents, there's people from all of those tents in our tents. And when they go home and they are all pretty much the same outwardly, we come back to this place where all of us are different from each other, right? And you look in this room, everybody's a little bit different from the people sitting next to them, you know? And what the point is of this class is to not just say, here's the how-tos, the do's and don'ts, like how we went through wudu for a good 3 weeks to talk about the mechanics of it, the spiritual aspects of it, these kinds of things. You also want to just ready yourself to think about where and how the depth of this religion is rooted in a shared theology that transcends cultural differences. But on a practical level, it's not necessarily always that easy to fit into some place when people normatively believe that the way that they do it is the only way to do it from a culturally hegemonic standpoint. And the base of this though in a like foundation class is that you want to understand that to convert to Islam doesn't mean you commit a cultural apostasy. And as you are navigating this and you are experiencing this, or you engage your own sense of religious journey, there are things that are absolutes, prohibitions, obligations. We talked about what is foundational theology in Islam, what makes somebody Muslim. And so this is a very important thing to understand, because you could walk into many Muslim spaces and the hope is that it's going to feel familiar, but the idea is that it can feel unfamiliar. But on the flip end of it, the same thing that brings those people together sociologically, shared language, shared food, shared culture, is not like a bad thing. And there's a familiarity that becomes necessary at times when you're exploring the religion and certain things make sense in terms of the theology and practice, but on a lived level, it's, I don't know how to be Muslim because an underlying element is, I don't know how to be Arab, I'm not Arab. I don't know how to be South Asian, I'm not South Asian, right? I'm Latino, I'm white, I'm black, African American. I'm not in this place. And what this article does, I think very nicely, is outlines the base of how Sharia relates to culture, and you want to be aware of this just as you navigate these things. Do you know, but where it goes in both directions, I'll give you an example. We had a young brother in our community who is half Puerto Rican and half Dominican, and he was celebrating like Eid with us for years. He prayed, he observed Ramadan, and then one night in Ramadan a few years ago, he sat with me and he said, you know, everything in this religion makes sense, but I don't know any Muslims who are Puerto Rican or Dominican like I am. And he says, it just makes it feel very much like it's not something for me. And I said, oh, my brother-in-law is Puerto Rican and Dominican. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, yeah, my sister is married to a guy who's Puerto Rican and Dominican. His name is Ulysses, really great. Yuli converted to Islam many years ago. After him, his younger brother Brian converted to Islam. And then in our center at Jummah, their sister, who's between them in age, took her shahada that year one day. And I introduced this guy to Yuli like a couple of days later. And they sat down and everything just like you could see felt so different to him. Do you know? It was very, very unique. We had another lady who came here for the first time for Jummah. And she was a convert and had come out of a place where she was the only person of her background. Just white lady, blonde hair, blue eyes. And she came in and the room was filled with like white people that day. And she sat down with me. She's like, I've never been to a masjid that has this many white Muslims. And I sat with her and I was like, there's a group visiting from Denmark today that is not Muslim. And they were just here to participate in Jummah. But I was like, but there's still people who are here who are converts, and they kind of get what you're talking about. But it was a need that she didn't even know that she had, right? And that's how we connect sociologically. We crave similarity and familiarity. In your own journey with Islam, you're going to run into people who cannot see Islam bigger than what they've been brought up with. They're going to only see kind of the culture that is infused with religion that doesn't negate who they are, but they see permissibility in this framework as normativity, that this is the only way to do something, as opposed to one of the ways that someone can do something. Do you get what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Yeah? So let's take a quick look at this article. We won't read the whole thing, but Dr. Omar Farouk Abdullah, he's from Chicago, and he wrote this like years ago. He's like a true scholar in the scholarly sense of things, like very intellectual, writes a lot about spirituality, theology. He's a professor in Saudi Arabia for some time, has lived all over the world, traces a lot of his shiuch, his teachers, to West Africa. And, you know, he's just a very, like, nice, kind man, right? And I think as you navigate religion and religious learning, you want to also think and distinguish between who your professors are and who your teachers are, right? Who you just take information from and who it is that you take a sense of just character and ethic from. And the distinction there becomes really important. And he's like a nice guy, right? So if we can just start with this first paragraph that says, for centuries, Islamic civilization harmonized indigenous forms of cultural expression. Does anybody want to read? People have it. We're looking at an article. It's called Islam and the Cultural Imperative by a man named Omar Farouk Abdullah. If you just Google it, on the first site that pops up, it's like an Oasis site. It'll say download English. So we can just download the English. Does anybody want to start reading? We're not going to read the whole thing.
You start with the sacred law.
For centuries, Islamic civilization harmonized indigenous forms. It looks like this when you download it. Yeah?
It struck a balance between temporal beauty and ageless truth, and fanned a brilliant peacock's tale of unity and diversity from the heart of China to the shores of the Atlantic. That's beautiful. That's a bar. Islamic jurisprudence helped facilitate this creative genius. In history, Islam showed itself to be culturally friendly, and in that regard, it has been likened to a crystal clear river. Its rivers, Islam, are pure, sweet, and life-giving, but have no color of their own, reflect the bedrock, indigenous culture, over which they flow. In China, Islam looks Chinese. In Mali, it looks African. Sustained cultural relevance to the distinct peoples, diverse places, and different times underlay Islam's long success as a global civilization. The religion became not only functional and familiar at the local level, but dynamically engaging, fostering stable indigenous Muslim identities and allowing Muslims to put down deep roots and make long-lasting contributions wherever they went.
So the idea was that when Islam came to a people, or a people embraced Islam, it wasn't that they lost a sense of who they were, right? The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the generation that is immediately around the Prophet Muhammad, his companions, they're called Sahaba. And the two qualities that one needs in order to be deemed to be a Sahaba, a companion, and I'll write the word on the board, but you're going to hear this word a lot. The word Sahaba, it denotes two things. One, that this was a person who met the Prophet in the course of their life. And two, they died in a state of faith in Islam, right? That it wasn't enough that they had one or the other, but they were both that categorically identified them to be a companion of the Prophet. He had companions that were young, companions that were old, people who were as young as his own grandsons, right? People who were as old as his uncles. But he was in a place where the connection as a generation identified was to the Prophet and how they experienced a relationship with him during the course of their life. The generation that comes after this, they're called the Tabi'een, and we don't have to get into them just yet, but to give you an idea, they have the same category of dying in a state of faith but they then interacted with someone who was a Sahaba, as opposed to interacting with the Prophet. Does that make sense? And the Prophet's companions, his Sahaba, they were definitely people who were Arab, people who were Quraysh, people who were of his clan and his tribe, but he also had people who came from all different walks of life, right? The major communities at this time were people, you know, Persians, Byzantines, Romans. So the Prophet has companions like Suhaib al-Rumi, Suhaib the Roman, you know, who white skin, blonde hair, blue-eyed. Bilal ibn Rabah, who is an Abyssinian slave, is a black man from Africa. Salman al-Farsi, who is Salman the Persian, right? He came from a different community. And we're talking about specifics, but to understand for each one of these names, there's so many more. They're not like a rarity, but this was a community that was meant to be rooted in an idea that it reflected a theology that there's one God. And you have to understand this as we go through it, because the next paragraph is going to juxtapose this to, you know, challenging realities that stem up quite often. But let's read the next paragraph. By contrast, much contemporary Islamist rhetoric. Who wants to read that? Anybody? You can keep going, Phil.
By contrast, much contemporary Islamist rhetoric falls far short of Islam's ancient cultural wisdom, assuming at times an unmitigated culturally predatory attitude. Such rhetoric and the movement ideologies that stand behind it have been deeply influenced by Western revolutionary dialectic and a dangerously selective retrieval and reinterpretation of Islamic scripture in that light. At the same time, however, the Islamist phenomenon is, to no small degree, a byproduct of the grave cultural dislocation and dysfunction of the contemporary Muslim world. Culture Islamic, or otherwise, provides the basis of social stability, but paradoxically, can itself only flourish in stable societies and will inevitably break down in the confusion of social disruption and turmoil. Today, the Muslim world retains priceless relics of its former cultural splendor, but in the confusion of our times, the wisdom of the past is not always understood, and many of its established norms and older cultural patterns no longer appear relevant to Muslims or seem to offer solutions. Where the peacock's tail has not long since folded, it retains little of its former dazzling fullness. Where the cultural river has not dried up altogether, its waters seldom run clear. Human beings generate culture naturally like spiders spin silk. But unlike spiders' webs, the cultures people construct are not always adequate, especially when generated unconsciously, in confusion, under unfavorable conditions, or without proper direction. Unsurprisingly, Muslim immigrants to America remain attached to the lands they left behind, but hardly, if ever, bring with them the full pattern of the once healthy cultures of their past, which, if they had remained intact, would have reduced their incentive to emigrate in the first place. Converts overwhelmingly African American, are often alienated from their own deep indigenous roots and native cultural sensibility through the destructive impact of culturally predatory Islamist ideologies from abroad.
Okay, so let's take a pause here, right? The article is going to introduce an objective reality. I wish it was not an objective reality, but it's an objective reality nonetheless, that we live in societies that are heavily stratified, deeply entrenched in ideas around supremacy, this country in particular rooted in anti-blackness. And when you have generationally within Muslim experience, individuals whose heritage incorporates slavery, colonization, the consequences of imperialism, there's a lot of generational trauma that gets passed on, the people stick to certain things. And to be Muslim doesn't denote a high level of literacy of Islam. You don't need a high level of literacy to have a high level of devotion, right? Like, when some of us are leaving for Umrah tomorrow, may Allah accept it from us, we're going to go to Mecca and Medina that every day has millions of people praying in the masjids there from all over the world. You can go to other religious sites And it's not to like knock anybody, but their main spaces of worship do not have that same level of devotion on a regular daily basis. And all these people who are praying in Mecca and Medina every day, all of them don't know all of the Quran. All of them don't know like the basics of Islam, right? It's not like an entry point to having a close relationship with God fundamentally. But when you're coming into it from the onset, and why we want to talk about it here and introduce it at this juncture, is because most convert classes, Islam 101 classes, foundation classes, they're just going to teach you the how-tos and the do's and don'ts of things. And there's not a, that's, there's a value to that, but we want you to also understand experientially, when you're born into it, you come to it later in life, you're a convert, an understanding that this becomes a challenge for many people living in as a diverse Muslim population as we have. There's some people who cannot separate the fact that in order for them to be right, that you have to be wrong just because you come from different places and you're born to different people. Do you get what I mean? And it can become very heavy, very challenging when you have to adopt an outward skin that now fits into somebody else's standard that is more culturally hegemonic than anything that is more kind of inviting. Do you get what I mean? Right? And so that's where this article is really important. If we can break it down to page number 4. There's a section that is headed Respecting Other Cultures, a Supreme Prophetic Sunnah. So the Sunnah refers in a technical sense to the authoritative example of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, peace and blessings be upon him. In a literal sense, it just refers to the authoritative example of any individual. But when it's talked about here, it's talking about the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Can somebody start to read from here? The Prophet Muhammad and his companions were not at war with the world's cultures. Yeah, go for it.
The Prophet Muhammad and his companions were not at war with the world's cultures and ethnicities, but entertained an honest, accommodating, and generally positive view of the broad social endowments of other peoples and places. The Prophet and his companions did not look upon human culture in terms of black and white, nor did they drastically divide human societies into spheres of absolute good and absolute good and absolute evil. Islam did not impose itself, neither among Arabs or non-Arabs, as an alien, partially predatory worldview. Rather, the prophetic message was from the outset based on a distinction between what was good, beneficial, and authentically human in other cultures, while seeking to alter only what was clearly detrimental. Prophetic law did not burn and obliterate what was distinctive about other peoples, but sought instead to prune, nurture, nourish, and create a positive Islamic synthesis. Much of what became the Prophet's Sunnah, prophetic model, was made up of acceptable pre-Islamic Arab cultural norms and the principle of tolerating and accommodating such practices among Arabs and non-Arabs alike in all their diversity, may be termed the supreme overriding prophetic sunnah. In this vein, the noted early jurist Abu Yusuf understood the recognition of good local cultural norms as a falling under the rubric of the sunnah. The 15th century Granadan jurist Putin Ibn al-Mawa articulated a similar outlook and stressed, for example, that it was not the purpose of prophetic dress codes to impinge upon the cultural integrity of non-Arab Muslims who were at liberty to develop or maintain their own distinctive dress within the broad parameters of the sacred law.
So people understand what this means, yeah? So I'd like you to do, just for a minute, we can take a pause, and turn to the person next to you. What are you taking away from this so far? Like, what are things we can extrapolate from this? Things that you might seem to be like very obvious, or things that you're kind of like, oh, I didn't know that. But also, how does it kind of relate to your own experience thus far? As you're exploring Islam, you're a convert, you're like born into it. This is like telling us what the basis is of a prophetic model of engagement. But I'd love to just have you all talk for a couple minutes to each other. What are some of the things it's bringing up for you or you're taking away? and we'll come back and discuss as a group. Go ahead. So you just turn to the person next to you, introduce yourself if you don't know them, and then you just talk for a couple of minutes. Okay, so what are some of the things that's bringing up for you, or you're taking away from it so far? What are we talking about in our groups? Who wants to start? Anybody? Yeah.
Mine was in reference to like the last couple of sentences that was just read, about not having to specifically wear a certain type of dress.
You coming?
Because there's a broad spectrum of what can be considered. It is specifically like modest is like my takeaway from it, and I don't culturally appropriate by wearing something a certain way, or if I should do my own thing. Like sometimes I'll wear just like a beanie. Sometimes I won't wear anything. This is my first time wearing a scarf ever. So, and I feel very comfortable in it, but that's another thing that I took from it is like, where do I fit on the spectrum when no one in my culture or family practices this type of modesty?
So yeah. And fleshing that out in a practice that's like very real, especially if you're converting into something and you've lived now for multiple years already prior to that moment, and you have friends and you have family. That's why like the very first thing we've talked about is like, who is God in all of this, right? Because if there's not a God-centric worldview and it's just you have to do this because this is what's done, then it just becomes more about the mechanics without a base that says, well, why am I doing certain things in certain ways, right? And we're gonna go through this whole section just because I think it's important, and then the rest you can read on your own. But there's gonna come to a part where he says it's also important to like let go of parts of culture that don't coincide with Islam as a religion, right? That there's this kind of sense of it not being absolute in one direction or the other, but there's a combination of saying we take what's good and we leave behind what's bad. But a big part of it is recognizing that you don't leave it all together, and the majority of it is going to actually be stuff that kind of fits in. Is that, you know what I mean? What else did we talk about? What else came up in your like smaller group discussions? Yeah, go for it.
Something that you just mentioned, I think we just kind of talked about weddings specifically in our culture.
Weddings?
Weddings, and how like sometimes it's not correct Islamically, but culturally it's like so accepted that sometimes even parents are like, we do it this way, but it's actually not correct. So I think like finding that line between like what's correct and what's not correct, and like, or even like marrying someone outside of like your culture is seen as really bad. And like I've seen that in my family, where if somebody married someone outside of like Pakistani idea, like everybody was just like, oh my god, like how could you, even though they committed to Islam. So I feel like that's where like culture and like that's like outside of like culture. It's like we want to like stick to that, but we don't want to have like a bigger picture of like what is accepted in like Islam.
Yeah, and the broader we has to be kind of broken down into I statements, because fundamentally as an individual, you have to determine for yourself what goes into your decisions, what goes into your choices, and where and how we can navigate it. But even in the prism of weddings, right? I do a lot of weddings, right? Point where I'm just like, you know, whoa, a lot of weddings. But what's amazing is when people are getting married from distinct cultures, and also people are getting married from the same culture, and you get to experience just like how deep again and beautiful Islam is, and the way that it just manifests in so many different traditions, and all of these weddings look so different than what is just sometimes deemed to be normative rather than simply permissible. Do you get what I mean? Right? I've done weddings for like Egyptians that are marrying Afghans, weddings for people who are Sudanese that are marrying Italian people, weddings for Pakistanis getting married to Egyptians, and people just blend all of their cultures together, right? And it's really amazing to see that it's a reflection of individuals, that that diversity can be embraced and appreciated, as opposed to you got to leave certain things at the table, or at the door rather, and they can't kind of be brought to the table. Do you see what I'm saying? And there's moments like this that we all experience, that just because it's unfamiliar doesn't mean that it doesn't fit in, and where and how you can understand at a base level when it's a God-centric religion that Islam claims to be for all of humanity. It's not making a claim that it's for all of humanity, and then all of humanity suddenly becomes as if they lived 1400 years ago in this generation, but you draw and extrapolate lessons and meanings and teachings from it. And it's one of the healthy ways that our religion embraces individualism, because even all of these people in this generation, they weren't all alike. They weren't all the same. They had different temperaments, different personalities, different demeanors. They struggled with different things. And it's really easy when you start to explore this religion and you walk into a space that they'll give you an aspect of Islam, but it's not Islam in its entirety. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? Okay, why don't we keep reading? The Quran enjoined the Prophet Muhammad, on page 4, the second column. The Quran enjoined the Prophet Muhammad to adhere to people's sound customs and usages and take them as a fundamental reference in legislation. Accept from people what comes naturally for them, command what is customarily good, and turn away from the ignorant without responding in kind. Ibn Atiyah, a renowned early Andalusian jurist and Quranic commentator, asserted that the verse not only upheld the sanctity of indigenous culture, but granted sweeping validity to everything the human heart regards as sound and beneficial, as long as it is not clearly repudiated in the revealed law. For classical Islamic jurists in general, the verse was often cited as a major proof text for the affirmation of sound cultural usage, and it was noted that what people generally deem as proper tends to be compatible with their nature and environment, serving essential needs and valid aspirations. The story of the sons of Arfida, a familial Arabian linguistic reference to Ethiopians, provides a telling illustration of the place of culture, here of course Black African culture, within the prophetic dispensation. In celebration of an annual Islamic religious festival, a group of Black African converts began to beat leather drums and dance with spears in the Prophet's mosque. Umar ibn al-Khattab, one of the chief companions, felt compelled to intervene and stop them, but the Prophet intervened on their behalf, directing Umar to leave them alone and noting to him that they were the sons of Arfida, that is, not his people. The Prophet invited his wife Aisha to watch the dance, took her into the crowd and lifted her over his back so that she could watch them clearly as she eagerly leaned forward, her cheek pressing against his. The Prophet made a point to dispel the Ethiopians' misgivings about Umar's intrusion and encouraged them to dance well, and in one account of this authentic story, reassured them to keep up their drumming and dancing, saying, "Play your game, son of Arfida, so the Jews and Christians know there is latitude in our religion." It's not that he's specifically saying this in reaction to other people of the book, but you contextualize this in terms of the broader people who are now situated at this time with him, that to join this religion doesn't mean that you let go of who you are, right? The explanation also of the story of the Banu Arfida is also not something that is tokenizing, but when you look at subsequent hadith traditions in the prophetic sunnah that refer to this instance, the dance that they're doing is more like a military step kind of dance, right? If you've ever seen people perform that kind of routine, you know, it's got like a little bit more than just, there was a crowd of people around them watching these guys dance. If it was a spectacle, there's like a sense of dignity and a sense of honor. You know, if you've ever seen people do like haka dances, right? If they come from a Samoan background and it's about like who they are culturally, and you can tell there's like an intensity that's there. That's what the Banu Arfida are doing here, right? They're doing this in this way that, you know, my friend Sheikh Obaidullah Evans, who is from Chicago also, and he was the first African American to graduate from the College of Islamic Law in Egypt at Al-Azhar University. He explains this hadith in that way. And he says the Banu Afda, they weren't just like dancing around, but they were doing this kind of like dignified, culturally adapted, like kind of military step dance. Does that make sense? But what the Prophet is telling his people, like his close companions, these people are not Arab. Just because it's not familiar to you doesn't mean that it's outside of the fold of Islam. Just because you're uncomfortable by it, because it's different, doesn't mean it doesn't belong within this. Let the people see there's latitude in this religion of ours. This does not negate the idea that there are prohibitions and obligations. But you fit what is essential, you take what is good from the culture, and what is in conflict with those parameters that we outlined, the permissible and the impermissible. There was so much more that was permissible than impermissible. Remember, we talked about the Ahkam Sharia, you know, what is obligatory, recommended, confirmed prophetic practice, like neutral, what is disliked, and what is strictly prohibited. Everything other than strictly prohibited falls into the category of what is potentially permissible, right? Even the category of disliked at times can be something that is still permissible. It's not to be done consistently, but it can still fall into permissibility. Do you see what I mean? And this is an important thing to understand, especially as you navigate Muslim communities in the United States. You're going to go through New York City. There's an Indonesian mosque, a Turkish mosque, Albanian mosque, the Bengali mosque, the Sudanese mosque, the Gambian mosque. You know, and it's not that these things are problematic. My grandfather did speak like English as a primary language. He would need a space that reflected his socialization, his upbringing, like the realities he found himself in. Sometimes spaces will have to be either or. They can't be all. It's very hard to create a space that like everybody feels like they can still be connected in that way. Do you get what I mean? And I just want you to be aware of that as you navigate some of these things and you navigate other people who are also very kind, but they might say to you like, oh, you can't do that, right? And you're like, I can't like eat French fries. Like, no, you know, Muslims don't do that, right? A good friend of mine is a Hafiz, comes from African American background, and he was leading prayer and he had on a baseball hat and he's like took off his hat every time he was praying. And I said, why do you take off your baseball hat? And he said, somebody told me it's haram to wear baseball hats, right? Like they're not kufis like this. And I was like, you can wear your baseball hat, man. It's a hat, you know, like it, that's, you know, but it's the conveyance of something is problematic twofold. One, you can't make something haram that's not haram. Like that's a big problem to do that. But two, just because it's different doesn't mean by default it's impermissible. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? Yeah? Do people understand why we're talking about this here in this space? Right? And it's not just about only here's like the legal rulings and the fiqh and the how-tos of wudu. This is going to be something that's really important, right? Like you could walk into a mosque that all they have is what we talked about last week when we're washing up from the bathroom. Remember, we're talking about like cleanliness and we don't simply use like toilet paper. In Islam, you gotta rinse off like anything that's considered to be filthy. And you could walk into a place that doesn't have a hand bidet. You could walk into places culturally like South Asian and they use like those large like watering pots that are called lotas. If you've never seen one before, you'd be like, what is this thing? It doesn't mean that they're wrong in what they're doing, but they're catering to the norm and majority of that space. But you don't have to just say, this is the only way to get it done. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, let's continue. The Prophet cultivated openness and objectivity towards others. This was also part of his lesson to Umar, and such openness enabled his companions to acknowledge the good in other cultures, even when, as was the case with the Byzantine Christians, Arum, they were not only hostile to the rise of Islamic power on their southern flank, but constituted Islam's most formidable enemy. When it was related to Amr ibn al-As, a companion of the Prophet, and victorious commander in the Byzantine Wars, that the prophet had prophesied that Arum, specifically the Byzantines, but understood in this context as a general reference to Europeans, would predominate at the end of time, Amr responded to his informer, "If then you have related this honestly, know that they have four excellent qualities. They are the most forbearing of people in times of discord. They are the quickest of people to recover from calamity. They are the most likely of people to renew an attack after retreat. And they are the best of people toward the poor, the orphan, and the weak." Amr then added, "And they have a fifth attribute, which is both beautiful and excellent. They are the best of people in checking the oppression of kings." Amr drew attention to those European cultural traits which he knew and regarded as both compatible with Islam's ethos and universally desirable as human qualities. His response demonstrates his understanding that the future prominence of Westerners would be an outgrowth of their exceptional cultural traits, which his mind immediately began to search out after hearing the Prophet's prophecy. Four came at once to his mind, and the fifth, "They're the best of people in checking the oppression of kings," occurred as an afterthought, but was clearly regarded amongst the most important. It was viewed as beautiful and excellent. They're finding a recognition that there's beauty in every culture, right? That there's not a reductive approach to Islam that says everybody's going to just suddenly be exactly the same way. And you have to be able to navigate this as you explore Islam as a faith to understand that the exploration of Islam as a religion doesn't mean that you have to let go of things that are inherently a part of who you are, right? I grew up the child of immigrants who are from Pakistan, experienced partition, and I run the Islamic Center, right? Story's true so far. And every day in Ramadan, we only serve the spiciest Pakistani, like, biryani and, like, food with all kinds of, like, oil and grease. Why would he not be able to assume that this is just what Muslims eat? Do you get what I mean? And you think then about familiarity, and it's like, man, I converted. They have me not eating during daylight, and then after the sun sets, I'm eating stuff that makes me gassy and creates ulcers in my stomach, right? But there's no sense of somebody might be different, and this isn't what's familiar to them. When I went to Myanmar the second time to work with Rohingya refugees there, they're facing ethnic cleansing, genocide, may Allah make things easy for them. One of the things that happens when you work in disaster relief is that you buy food in large quantities and they ship whatever they can, sometimes not thinking about what is like the actual makeup of these people. So if you're old enough to remember when Haiti went through a lot of natural disasters and people were sending all kinds of food to Haiti, they were sending food in large quantities, inclusive of like rice and other things that were not native to Haitian diets. And then the people of Haiti start to develop all kinds of illnesses related to eating that they never had before because they could have no choice but to eat the food that they had. And when I went to Islamic Relief to Myanmar, and there was refugees now that came from there and were living in Bangladesh, one of the things that the Islamic Relief staff did, subhanAllah, really remarkable, was to, in specific, bring strands of rice that were native from Myanmar to these people who had fled ethnic cleansing and genocide. Not like the rice that was native to Bangladesh. And I sat with people as they ate it. These people, for 10 months, all they ate was rice every meal. And then we started to bring them different things. But when they ate this different rice, I kid you not, there was people who just had tears pouring out of their eyes. Because they tasted something that was familiar to them, that was of like their culture and their background. Do you get what I mean? Right? It's not an either or, it's a both and. It's something that's important to understand. The word for Islamic law is not like law the way like you drive through a red light and you get a ticket. You don't want to think about Sharia in that way. But The most literal translation of this is that it's a path to water. Or the path to the watering well. So the path to the watering well, you conceptualize this now. If you know the story of Abraham and Hagar, Hajar, peace be upon her, Ismail, they get left in the deserts of Arabia with nothing but some dates and water, right? When that runs out, baby Ismail kicks at the desert floor. Hajar runs between two mountains called Safa and Marwa looking for some nourishment for the child. Where his feet are kicking, the angel comes and strikes the ground, and a well known as the Well of Zamzam steps forward. This water starts to collect, animals start to flock in the middle of the desert. A tribe called the Jurham tribe sees the animals, sends some emissaries to see what's taking place. Their astonishment, what they thought would be nothing, was now a large body of water and this elderly woman and her child. And they ask, can we live here? And she said, yes, but the water is under my ownership. And this is where the city of Mecca establishes itself, right? But the idea is that the water attracts life to it. Right, Sharia is a path to water, is that the implementation of Sharia is meant to give you vibrancy and vitality. It's meant to be expansive, not restrictive. There's going to be prohibitions and obligations, but its implementation rooted in a God-centric worldview allows for there to be that sense of liberation. But sometimes what becomes suffocating is this culturally hegemonic attitude towards religion. And you conceptualize any body of water. From the largest of oceans to the smallest of raindrops, they can be approached in a multitude of ways. You don't approach most body of water just from one pathway. It can be approached in a lot of pathways. That's how Sharia functions. You can approach it in a lot of pathways. There's verses that say, don't eat pork. They mean don't eat pork. There's no other way to work around it. That's just what it means. But there's a lot of other things that will manifest in different ways. And this is what Dr. Omar is saying in this article, that culture, custom is taken into consideration as practice comes about. My wife's name is Priya. She converted to Islam 23 years ago. And when we got married, this is gonna be our 12th year of marriage this September, inshallah. And my wife, when she got married to me, I would just write about her in various places, op-eds, social media, etc. And my social media platforms, I have people that engage me from different parts of the world. And there was people that would write on my postings things like, did you marry somebody who's Hindu? And my wife has practiced Islam longer than I have. And initially, I would get very agitated. And I was writing daily op-eds for the Huffington Post in Ramadan, some years ago. And so I wrote one that said, people asked me why my wife's name is Priya, and I said, because that's the name her parents gave her. It was a very angry, kind of thing. And then some years passed, and something similar happened. And in my head, I was now a little bit older, not speaking on my wife's behalf in any way, but I wrote something different. And some people said the same thing. And I said, well, why would they know it to be different? If you go to India and Pakistan, to be Indian is to be Hindu, to be Pakistani is to be Muslim. If you've ever watched a Bollywood movie, the quintessential name for every Bollywood heroine is Priya, right? And these people have never experienced this ever before. They fundamentally can't grasp the idea that somebody who is Indian and Hindu converted to Islam. And they then couldn't understand also how her name, being what it was a completely fine Muslim name, right? It didn't have to be an Arabic name. Do you get what I mean? Right? My daughter's name is Medina Noor Latif. All three Arabic names. My son's name is Kareem Gabriel Latif. And we didn't name him Jibrail to Arabize it. We named him Gabriel because we like the name Gabriel. It's a really beautiful name. One of my friends who's Sheikh studied Islam for years in Syria. He named his daughter Hope, right? It's a beautiful name. That's what names have to have. They have good meanings, right? But this is what Sharia is. It's a path to water. It's not singular. It only looks one way, right? But there's sometimes multitudes of ways to get to certain places. Does that make sense? So what I want you to do is just to like sit with this, read the rest of the article, and allow for it to kind of soak in so that you can understand that engaging this religion doesn't mean you have to let go of parts of who you are. There will be things that every culture has that is not Islamic. This culture has a lot of real noble traits. It also has a lot of traits that are deeply racist. They do not coincide with what Islam teaches. And to be in a place where one says, I have to leave behind some of these things, then you have to leave behind it. The other things that come into here are important to understand because everybody's family is not Muslim. Everybody's family, even if they're Muslim, they might not practice Islam like you. There's not going to necessarily be always like uniformity across. People are going to engage in practices in different levels. And as you navigate some of these things and you Google stuff, there's all kind of information out there, but nobody's teaching you what it means. It's just going to be more and more suffocating. They're like, well, there's this many opinions on this, and this many opinions on that. It all falls under this idea, but none of it says you have to forego and commit a cultural apostasy to become Muslim. Does that make sense? Okay. So we're going to take a pause in a minute to pray. We are not meeting next Wednesday, but from the Wednesday after, we will meet, and we'll meet at 7 on that Wednesday after. It's the last day before Ramadan starts. So not the coming Wednesday, but the Wednesday after. I don't know what the date is. 2 weeks from now. After that, in Ramadan, we will meet at 6 o'clock in this room on Wednesdays instead of at 7. Does that work for people? Especially those who have been coming consistently. Can you get here by 6? Yeah. Anybody have an issue with it? You can tell me. Yeah. And through Ramadan, we'll meet at 6 and we'll go through other stuff. I think next week, or the next time we meet, which will be 2 weeks from now, we might pivot a bit, and instead of continuing with some of the, like, you know, washing up and wudu and this kind of stuff, we'll talk about Ramadan in specific, like the do's and don'ts of Ramadan, how that kind of functions, what you can like kind of expect and anticipate within Ramadan. But throughout the course of the month, we'll then go back to like some of what we're talking about, so there's continuity throughout what it is that we're discussing, we'll kind of take it from there. Does that make sense? Does that sound good? Okay, great. So we're going to take a pause. Khalid and I and Solo are tomorrow going to Mecca and Medina. Inshallah, we'll be in Saudi Arabia for the next week. That's why we won't be here next Wednesday. If anybody needs anything or wants anything from there, please let us know. We'll do our best to get that for you. All of you are definitely in our prayers. We're taking a smaller pilgrimage that's called the Umrah. It's different from the Hajj pilgrimage, and that the Umrah can be done in a few hours. It doesn't have to be done at a specified time of the year. It can be done at any time in the calendar year. We're looking forward to perhaps one day doing, you know, a specific Umrah for our conversations group, or things that kind of are more, you know, segmented to helping to meet some of the needs of some of the people that, you know, come to us through our conversations group. But if anybody needs anything, please do let us know. We'll do our best to get that for you. Does anybody have any questions or anything they want to add in before we wrap up? Yeah, so please read the article in its entirety. It's a really important thing to understand as a base, so that when you enter into certain spaces, you can get to a place where you recognize, this is why this person is potentially telling me that I need to like do some of these things that I'm doing. But if it doesn't feel familiar because you're not of that background, that's okay, right? And you can still have gentleness and compassion, unless they're like inhibiting you from your growth. Do you know what I mean? And being in a place then where you have to then deal with like certain realities. And I want to be very transparent with you. It becomes hard for sometimes people who convert to Islam quite often, because people speak in languages that they don't understand around them, don't invite them to things because they don't share like culture. You know, connections are just rooted in externals and not internals. And that's not like what Islam is about fundamentally. But we want to kind of be in a place where we're on the same page In terms of what your experiences will be and how we can pivot and shift that, as Khalid was saying. So we're building the spaces and offering insights so that it's getting better, and then in another generation it'll be that much better. Do you get what I mean? Okay, assalamu alaikum.